The Lightning Tower by Dan Abnett, read by John Banks.
What are you afraid of? What are you really afraid of?
There was once a fine palace, and it sat like a crown of light upon the top of the world. This was in the latter days, when mankind left his birthrock for the second time, to chase a destiny denied him in a previous epoch. The artisan masters of the many rival Masonic guilds had raised the palace up, block by gilded block, to be a statement of unity, regal and unequivocal. After a dreary, lightless age of strife, the warring tribes and creeds of terror had been alloyed under one rule, and the palace was intended to symbolize that staggering achievement. All the petty dynasts and ethnarchs, all the clanations and genesepts, all the despots and pan-continental tyrants had been quelled or crushed, overthrown or annexed. Some, the smartest and most prescient, had offered terms and been embraced to the bosom of the new rule. Better fealty than the wrath of the warriors in thunder armour. Better submission than the enmity of the world's new master. It was said that once you had seen him or heard him speak, you were never in doubt again. He was the one, and had always been the one. He had been the emperor long before there was any such office to take. No one knew his birth name, because he had always naturally been the emperor. Even the artisan masters of the Masonic guilds, famous for their sanctimonious craft wars and vainglorious quarrels, shut up and, in concert, built the palace for him. It was monumental. It was not so much an edifice as a handcrafted landmass. The artisan masters built it upon Terra's greatest mountain range and transformed the monstrous peaks into its bulwarks. It towered above a world laid to waste by centuries of war and perdition, and though that world was being rebuilt, with wondrous cities and architectural marvels blooming in the new age of unity, nothing could match its magnificence. For it was beautiful, a euphoric vision of gold and silver. It was said that when they had finished their task, the artisan masters of the Masonic guilds set down their tools and wept. By the time it was complete, it was the largest single man-made structure in known space. Its footings sank deep into the planet's mantle. Its towers probed the airless limits of the atmosphere. It owned the words, "The Palace, Holy," without any need for qualification, as if no other palaces existed. He had blemished that glory. He had raised dark curtain walls around the golden halls and cased the soaring towers in skins of armour 10 meters thick. He had stripped away the jewelled facades and the Cristelefantine ornamentation, the delicate minarets and the burnished cupolas, and in their places he had implanted uncountable turrets and ordnance emplacements. He had dug mighty earthworks out of the surrounding lowlands and fortified them with 1 million batteries. He had yoked platforms into synchronous orbits to guard from above, their weapon banks armed and trained day and night. He had put his men upon the walls, armoured in gold and set for the coming war. His name was Dawn, and he was not proud of his work. Vadok Singh, the war mason, had a habit of stroking architectural plans as he laid them out, as if they were a beloved pet. "Necessity," he said, his favourite word, stroking out the revised schemata of the Dawalagiri elevation.
"It's ugly," said Dawn.
He stood away from the table, leaning against one of the planning chamber's thick columns, his arms folded across his broad chest.
"Ugly is what they will do if they find the Annapurna Gate weak and flimsy," Singh replied.
He stood back and lit his bock pipe from a taper, allowing his flock of slaves to finish laying out the designs and adjusting the brass armature of the viewing lenses that would magnify details and project them onto the chamber wall for closer examination. Dawn shrugged.
"It's still ugly. The orbis and lazulite work encrusting that gate took Menzo of Travert 30 years to complete. Pilgrims flock here simply to see it. They say it surpasses even the Eternity Gate in its aesthetic."
"Aesthetic now," Singh smiled. He began to pace, trailing blue smoke from the bowl of his long-stemmed pipe. His slaves followed him up and down the chamber, like a timorous litter of young following their mother. Singh was a tall man, taller than the Primarch, but skeletally thin. His guild gene-bred their bloodline to favour height for purposes of surveying and overseeing.
I do so love our conversations, Rogal. They are quite contrary. You, the warrior, and me, the craftsman, and you lecture me on aesthetics.
I'm not lecturing, Dorn replied.
He was aware of Sigismund and Archimus in the corner of the great room, stiffening at the War Mason's use of his forename. Dorn would hear about proper respect and protocol again later.
Of course you're not, said Singh, but it is a necessity. How many legions does the upstart have with him now?
Dorn heard Sigismund rise to his feet. He turned and stared at the first captain of the Imperial Fists. Sigismund glowered back for a second, then left the chamber. Dorn glanced back at the War Mason.
Too many, he said.
Singh held out a long, spindly arm in the direction of the schemata.
So?
Begin work tomorrow at sunrise. Dismantle the gate with care and store the dismantled elements in the vaults. We will put the work back when this is done.
Singh nodded.
We will put everything back, thought Dorn. When this is done, we will put everything back the way it was.
A katabatic wind was coming in off the lower bulwarks that night. The palace was so immense, the precipice walls bred their own microclimate. Greasy stars swam in the heat ripple of the palace's new reactors. The void shields were being tested again.
Not a palace. Not the palace anymore. A fortress.
Some of those sullen stars were orbital platforms, catching the last backscatter of the sunlight as Terra turned. Dorn put on a fur-edged robe that had been in his possession since his adolescence on Inwit, and went out to walk the parapets of the Dalawagiri prospect, to dwell upon its beauty one last time. It was one of the last sections of the palace that remained untouched. Adamantium armour plates, drab, pre-stressed rockcrete, and auto-turrets had yet to blight its ethereal lines. Soon, though. From the wall, Dorn could see the 500,000 campfires of the Masonic host, the labour army that would invade the prospect come sunrise with their mallets and chisels and cranes. The robe had been his grandfather's, though Dorn had long since understood that no ties of blood linked him to the Inuit ice caste that had raised him. He had been created from another genetic line, that most singular line, in a sterile vault deep beneath him in the buried core of the palace.
Not a palace. Not the palace anymore. A fortress.
Dorn had been built to rule, built to assist in his father's tireless ambitions, built to make the hard decisions. He had been made as a Primarch, one of only 20 in the galaxy, engineered by the master architect of mankind, the Archmason of genetic code.
The Imperium needs many things, but foremost it needs the ability to protect itself, to attack when necessary. That's why I gave it 20 strong teeth in its mouth.
Attacking was a remarkably easy thing to do. Dorn's physical prowess humbled all but 20 human beings in creation, and those 20 were his father and his 19 brothers. In Dorn's opinion, the real art was knowing when not to attack. His grandfather, the old Inuit sire, patriarch of the Ice Hive clan, had taught him that. Dorn had been the 7th lost son to be reclaimed. By the time his father's forces found him, he had become a system warlord in his own right, ruling the Inuit cluster as the head of the House of Dorn. His grandfather had been dead 40 winters, but still the warlord had slept with a fur-edged robe across his body at night. His people had called him Emperor until the true meaning of that title had been demonstrated by 1,000 warships in the Inuit sky. Dorn had gone out to meet his father aboard Phalanx, one ship against thousands. But what a ship! A fortress! His father had been impressed. Dorn had always excelled in the construction of fortresses. That was why Dorn had returned to Terra with his gene sire. Out of love, out of devotion, out of obedience, yes, but most of all, out of necessity. Damn Sing. The stars had turned over, and chaos had spilled out from under them. The brightest of all had fallen, and the unthinkable, the heretical, had become fact. The Imperium was attacking itself. The War Master, for reasons Dawn was quite at a loss to fathom, had turned upon their father and was committing his forces to all-out war. That war would come to Terra. There was no question. It would come. Terra needed to be ready. The palace needed to be ready. His father had asked him, as a personal boon, to return to Terra and fortify it for war. No better man for the task, no better master of defences. Dawn and his fists, appointed the Emperor's Praetorians, could fend off any attack. Below him, the halls of Terra were silent and the walls deep. The only sound was the distant, eternal hum of the Astronomicon. The palace Dawn had armoured and defaced sat like a dark crown on the top of the world. Rogal Dawn had built many of the finest strongholds in creation. The city fortresses on Zavamunda, the pylon spire of Galant, the donjons along the Ruthen marches. Impregnable bastions all, palaces for governor lords to rule from. None of them had been so essential as this fortification. None of them had been as painful to accomplish. It had been like blotting out the light or draining a sea. The bright glory of his father's triumph, the enduring monument to unity, had been entombed inside a crude shell of utilitarian defence. All because of Horus, because of the brightest bastard son, the bringer of new strife. Dawn heard stone splinter. He looked down. He had punched his fist, his imperial fist, through a block of stone in the parapet. He had barely registered the impact. The block was pulverized.
My lord, is everything all right?
Archimus had shadowed him from the planning chamber. Never so volatile as Sigismund, Archimus was the master of Dawn's Huskarl retinue. There was a worried look on Archimus's face.
Just venting my emotions, Dawn said.
Archimus regarded the splintered block.
Making work for Sing's artisans, then? Something like that.
Archimus nodded. He hesitated and looked out over the high walls toward the distant earthworks of the Mahabharat.
You have wrought a wonder, you know. I have ruined one.
I know you hate it, but it had to be so, and no one could have done it better. Dawn sighed.
You're kind, old friend, but my heart is lead. This should never have been necessary. I search the limits of my imagination, and still I can conceive of nothing that begins to explain this war. Pride and ambition, insult, jealousy, they are not enough, not nearly enough, not for a Primarch. They are too petty and mortal to drive a Primarch to such extremity. They might provoke an argument, a feud at the worst. They would not split the galaxy in half.
Dawn looked up at the night sky.
And yet, against all reason, he comes.
Gilliman will stop him.
Rabute is far away.
Russ, then. The lion. The Khan.
Dawn shook his head.
I don't think they'll stop him either. I think he'll roll on until he reaches us.
Then we'll stop him, said Archimus. Won't we, sir?
Of course we will. I just wish...
What?
Nothing.
You wish what, sir? Archimus asked.
Nothing.
The wind suddenly pulled at Dawn's fur-edged robe. Above them, the shields went out, and then test-fired again.
Can I ask you a question, sir? Asked Archimus.
Of course.
Who are you really afraid of?
Consider the question, Rogal Dawn. The first axiom of defense is to understand what you defend against.
What are you afraid of? Who are you afraid of?
Dawn paced the halls of the Kathmandal precinct, where the organs of the Adeptus Terror did their work. The precinct, an entire city contained within the terraced compounds of the inner palace, never slept. Robed clerks and burnished servitors bustled along the broad concourses. Ministers and ambassadors conducted business beneath the kilometer-high roof of the Hegemon. The great mechanism of the Imperium whirred about him, its relentless function like a ticking timepiece. This was what unity had brought, this and the near measureless expanse of worlds and dominions that it guided and administered. For 200 years, the Emperor and his Primarchs had fought to create the Imperium. They had waged the Great Crusade from star to star to forge the Imperium of Man, an epic undertaking they had all made without hesitation, because they believed with utter conviction in the bright destiny it would shape for their species. They had all believed, all of them.
What was he afraid of? Who was he afraid of? Angron? Not him. Dawn would split his head without compunction if they came face to face. Lorgar? Magnus? There had always been a fetid whiff of sorcery about those two, but Dawn felt nothing towards them he could describe as fear. Fulgrim? No. The Phoenician was a singular foe, but not an object of terror. Perturabo? Well, now, their rivalry was old, the spiteful scrapping of two brothers who fought for a father's attention.
Dawn smiled, despite his mood. His years of exchanged insults with Perturabo seemed almost comical compared to this. They were too much alike, too jealous of one another's oh-so-similar abilities. Dawn knew it was a weakness for him to have risen to the Iron Warrior's baiting, but competition had always been a motivating force amongst the Primarch brothers. It had been encouraged as a factor to drive them on to greater and yet greater accomplishments.
No, he was not afraid of Perturabo.
Horus Lupercal, then? Dawn's aimless wanderings had taken him to the Investiary. In that broad space, an amphitheatre open to the night sky, statues of the 20 stood on ouslite plinths in a silent ring. There was no one around. Even the custodian guard was absent. Lumen orbs glowed on black iron poles. The Investiary was 2 kilometres in diameter. Under the glittering stars, it felt like an arena where 20 warriors had gathered to make their combat. The 2nd and 11th plinths had been vacant for a long time. No one ever spoke of those 2 absent brothers. Their separate tragedies had seemed like aberrations. Had they in fact been warnings that no one had heeded? Sigismund had urged that the effigies of the traitors also be removed from the Investiary. He had offered to do the work himself. This, Dawn recalled, had made the Emperor laugh. For the time being, the traitors had been shrouded. Their towering, draped forms seemed like phantoms in the blue darkness.
Horus, then. Was it Horus? Perhaps.
Dawn knew that Horus was the greatest of them, which made him the gravest foe. Could any one of them hope to best Lupercal on the field of war? Martial prowess was hardly the point. Dawn had never feared an adversary in his life because of how strong he was or how hard he fought. Combat was only ever a test. What mattered, what engendered fear, was why an adversary fought. What made him fight?
Oh, now we have it. Now the truth dawns.
He felt the hairs on his skin rise.
I am not afraid of Horus. I am afraid of finding out why he has turned against us. I cannot conceive of any justification for this schism, but Horus must have his reasons. I am afraid that when I know them, when they are explained to my baffled mind, I might agree.
Would you tear them all down?
Dawn turned at the sound of the voice. For a moment it had sounded like the soft growl of his father. But it was just a man. A cloaked and cowled man, scarcely half Dawn's height. His robes were those of a simple palace administrator.
What did you say? Asked Dawn.
The man walked out into the circle of the investiture to face Dawn. He greeted him with the old salute of unity, rather than the sign of the Aquila.
"You were staring at the statues of your kin," he observed. "I asked, would you tear them all down?"
"The statues or my kin, Sigilite?" Dawn replied.
"Both. Either."
"The statues, perhaps.
I believe Horus is doing a fine job with the men themselves."
Malkador smiled and looked up at Dawn. Like Dawn's, his hair was white. Unlike Dawn's, it was long, like a mane. Malkador was an exceptional being. He had been with the Emperor from the inception of the Unification Wars, serving as aide, confidant, and advisor. He had risen to become the master of the Council of Terror. The Emperor and the Primarchs were genetically advantaged post-humans, but Malkador was just a man, and that was what made him exceptional. He stood on a par with the post-human masters of the Imperium, and he was just a man.
"Will you walk with me, Rogal Dorn?
Are there not matters of state that require your attention, even at this hour, sir? The Council will bemoan your absence from the debating table."
"The Council can manage for a while without me," Malkador replied. "I like to take the air at this time of night. The Imperium never rests, but at night, up here in the thin air of the old Himalaya, I find there is at least an illusion of rest, a time to think and free the mind. I walk, I close my eyes. The stars do not go out because I am not looking at them."
"Not yet," said Dawn. Malkador laughed.
"No, not yet."
They said little at first. They left the investiture and walked along the beige stones of the precinct's highest terraces, between the weeping fountains. They walked as far as Lion's Gate, onto the platforms that overlooked the docking rings and landing fields of the Brahmaputra Plateau. The gate had once been a thing of magnificence, two gilded beasts rising up to lock claws in a feral dispute. Dawn's order of works had replaced them with giant grey donjons stippled with casemates and macro gunports. A curtain wall of bleak rockcrete encircled the gate, its edge fletched with void field veins like the spines of some prehistoric reptile. They stood and considered it for a long time.
"I am not a subtle man," Malkador said at length.
Dawn raised his eyebrows.
"Oh, all right," said Malkador. "Perhaps I am. Guile comes easily to a politician. I know I am considered cunning." "An old word, with no more meaning than wise," Dawn replied. "Indeed. I will accept that as a compliment. All I meant to say was, I will not attempt to be subtle now."
"No.
The Emperor has expressed his concerns."
"Meaning?"
Dawn asked. Malkador answered with a slight sigh.
"He understands you are filled with misgivings."
"Only natural, I would think, given the circumstances," said Dawn.
The Sigilite nodded.
"He trusts you to undertake the defense. He counts on you. Terror must not fall, no matter what Horus brings. This palace must not fall. If it is to end here, then it must end in our triumph. But he knows, and I know, and you know, that any defense is only as strong as its weakest part. Faith, belief, trust."
"What are you telling me?"
"If there is doubt in your heart, then that is our weakness."
Dawn looked away. "My heart is sad because of what I have been made to do to this place. That is all it is."
"Is it? I don't think so. What are you really afraid of?"
Malkador raised his hand, and the lights in his chambers came on. Dawn looked around. He had never entered the Sigilite's private apartments before. Ancient images hung on the walls, flaking, fragile things of wood, canvas, and decomposing pigments, preserved in thin, blue fields of stasis. The smoke-pale portrait of a woman with the most curious smile. Garish yellow flowers rendered in thick paint. The unflinching, roomy gaze of an old, fleshy man, cast in shadow, tobacco brown. Along another wall hung old tattered banners, showing the thunderbolt and lightning strike sigil of the pre-Unity armies. Suits of armor, perfect, glinting thunder armor, were mounted in shimmering suspension zones. Malkador offered Dawn wine, which he refused, and a seat, which he accepted.
"I have made a certain peace with myself," Dawn said. "I understand what I am afraid of."
Malkador nodded. He had pulled back his cowl, and the light shone on his long white hair. He sipped from his glass.
"Enlighten me. I do not fear anyone. Not Horus, not Fulgrim, none of them. I fear the cause. I fear the root of their enmity."
"You fear what you don't understand."
"Exactly. I'm at a loss to know what drives the War Master and his cohorts. It is an alien thing to me, quite defying translation. A strong defense relies on knowing what you are defending against. I can raise all the bulwarks and curtain walls and cannon bastions I like, and I still won't know what it is I'm fighting."
"Perceptive," said Malkador, "and true of us all. I fancy even the Emperor doesn't fully understand what it is that drives Horus against us so furiously. Do you know what I think?"
"Tell me."
Malkador shrugged.
"I believe it is better that we don't know. To understand it would be to understand insanity. Horus is quite mad. Chaos is inside him."
"You say that as if chaos is a thing."
"It is. Does that surprise you? You've known the warp and seen its corrupting touch. That's chaos. It has touched humanity now, twisted our brightest and best. All we can do is remain true to ourselves and fend it off, deny it. Trying to understand it is a fool's errand. It would claim us, too."
"I see." "Don't see, Rogal Dorn, and you will live longer. All you can do is acknowledge your fear. That's all any of us can do. Recognize it for what it is. Your pure human sanity, rocked by the sight of the warp's infecting, suffocating madness."
"Is this what the Emperor believes?" asked Dorn.
"It's what he knows. It's what he knows he doesn't know. Sometimes, my friend, there is salvation in ignorance."
Dorn sat still for a while. Malkador watched him, occasionally sipping from his glass.
"Well, I thank you for your time, sir," said Dorn eventually. "Your candor, too. I should..." "There is one other thing," said Malkador, setting his glass down and rising to his feet. "Something I want to show you."
Malkador crossed the chamber and took something from a drawer in an old bureau. He walked back to Dorn and spread that something out on the low table between them. Dorn opened his mouth, but no sound issued. Fear gripped him.
"You recognize these, of course."
Old cards, worn and fraying, discolored and liver-spotted with time. One by one, Malkador laid them out.
"The Lesser Arcanoi. Just gaming trinkets, really, but used widely before the coming of Old Night for divination. This deck was made on Nostramo Quintus."
"He used them,"
Dorn breathed.
"Yes, he did. He relied on them. He believed in cartomancy. He dealt his fate out, night after haunted night, and watched how the cards fell. Oh, holy terror." "Are you all right, sir?"
Malkador asked, looking up.
"You are quite pale."
Dorn nodded.
"Curse." "Yes, curse. Had you forgotten him? Or simply blocked him out?"
You have bickered and sparred with many of your brothers over the years, but only Conrad Kurz ever hurt you.
Yes.
He nearly killed you.
Yes.
On Sharo, long ago. I remember it well enough.
Malkador looked up at Dorn. The Primarch had risen to his feet.
Then sit back down and tell me, because I wasn't there.
Dorn sat.
This is so long ago, or like another life. We had brought the Sharo system to compliance. It was hard fought. The Emperor's children, the Night Lords, and my fists, we effected compliance. But Kurz didn't know when to stop. He never knew when to stop.
And you rebuked him?
He was an animal. Yes, I rebuked him. Then Fulgrim told me.
Told you what?
Dorn closed his eyes.
The Phoenician told me what Kurz had told him. The fits, the seizures that had plagued Kurz since his childhood on Nostromo, the visions. Kurz said he had seen the galaxy in flames, the Emperor's legacy overthrown, legionaries turning on legionaries. It was all lies, an insult to our creed.
You confronted Kurz?
And he attacked me. He would have killed me, I think. He is insane. That's why we drove him out, sick of his bloodletting. That's why he burned his homeworld and took his Night Lords off into the darkest parts of the stars.
Malkador nodded and continued to deal the cards.
Rogal, he is what you are truly afraid of, because he is fear incarnate. No other Primarch uses terror as a weapon like Kurz does. You are not afraid of Horus and his sallow heretics. You are afraid of the fear that sides with him, the night terror that advances alongside the traitors.
Dorn sat back and breathed out.
He has haunted me, I confess. All this time he has haunted me.
Because he was right. His visions were true. He saw this heresy coming in his visions. That is the truth you fear. You wish you had listened.
Dorn looked down at the cards laid out on the table before him.
Do you believe in this divination, Sigilite?
Let's see,
said Malkador, turning the cards over one by one. The moon, the martyr, and the monster. The dark king askew across the emperor. One other card. The lightning tower. Dorn groaned.
A bastion, blown out by lightning. A palace, brought to ruin by fire. I've seen enough.
The card has many meanings, said Malkador. Like the death card, it is not as obvious as it seems. In the hives of Nordmerica, it symbolized a change in fortune, an overturning of fate. To the tribes of Frank and Tali, it signified knowledge or achievement obtained through sacrifice.
A flash of inspiration, if you will. One that tumbles the world you know down, but leaves you with a greater gift.
The Dark King lies across the Emperor, said Dorn, pointing. Malkador sniffed.
It is not exactly a science, my friend.
They had blown their way through the massive earthwork defences at Haldwani and Jigaze. The sky at the top of the world was on fire. Despite the bombardments of the orbital platforms and the constant sorties of the Stormbirds and the Hawkwings, the traitor legions advanced, up through the Brahmaputra, along the delta of the Karnali. Continental firestorms raged across the Gangetic Plain. As they entered the rampart outworks of the palace, the streaming, screaming multitudes and the striding war machines were greeted by monsoons of firepower. Every emplacement along the Dawalagiri prospect committed its weapons. Laz reached out in neon slashes, annihilating everything it touched. Shells fell like sleet. Titans exploded, caught fire, collapsed on their faces, and crushed the warriors swarming around their heels. Still they came. Lancing beams struck the armor-reinforced walls like lightning smiting a tower. The walls fell. They collapsed like slumping glaciers. Gold-cased bodies spilled out, tumbling down in the deluge. The palace began to burn. Primus Gate fell. Lion's Gate, subjected to attack from the north. Annapurna Gate. At the ultimate gate, the traitors finally sliced into the palace, slaughtering everyone they found inside. Around every broken gate, the corpses of titans piled up in vast jumbled heaps where they had fallen over each other in their desire to break in. The heretic host clambered across their carcasses, pouring into the palace, yelling out the name of their...
End simulation, said Dawn.
He gazed down at the hololithic table. At his command, the forces of the enemy withdrew, unit by unit, and the palace rebuilt itself. The smoke cleared.
Reset parameters to Horus, Perturabo, Angron, and Kurz.
Opposition? The table queried.
Imperial Fists, Blood Angels, White Scars. Resume and replace scenario.
The map flickered. Armies advanced. The palace began to burn again.
Play it out, simulation after simulation, if you like, said the voice behind him. Simulations are just simulations. I know you won't fail me when the time comes.
Dawn turned.
I would never knowingly fail you, Father, he said. Then don't be afraid. Don't let fear get in your way.
What are you afraid of? What are you really afraid of?
The Lightning Tower, thought Rogal Dorn. I understand its meaning. Achievement obtained through sacrifice. I'm just afraid of what that sacrifice might be.
That was The Lightning Tower by Dan Abnett, read by John Banks.